Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This week on Must FC TV, we got something special and different for you for format wise, and it is absolutely fantastic. I am giddy, and you will figure out why I'm giddy. I'm not going to wait to spoil it. John Astin is on this episode. John Astin and Eva Kinsey Astin are on this episode. We'll be touching upon the Addams Family Portrait of Gomez, and because I'm a stickler and I love to get them credits in, we have to say Portrait of Gomez is the 13th episode of season 2. It was written by Bill Lutz, Leo Salkin, and Henry Sharp. It was directed by Sindri Salkow. Prime Video describes the episode as Morticia's pet plant Cleopatra gobbles up her favorite photo of Gomez from the family album. And no, that does not accurately describe the episode. It goes crazy. But you know what? This is an actual dream come true. So just like buckle up, because as you'll hear, I was not actually certain that John Astin was going to be baking.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Making an appearance. So the surprise you hear is actual mind-blown surprise. Enjoy, and thank you so much, all the listeners, for 100 episodes. Please rate and review the show in iTunes. Whatever, just here we go. This is amazing. It's a perfect night for moonbathing, and it is time for Must Have Seen TV, the podcast dedicated to the sitcoms of the 20th century from I Love Lucy to News Radio. I'm your TV guy, Brett White, and I'm also a senior reporter, producer for Decider.com, and this is part, I don't know, 22, 23, 24 of the quarantine era. This is just the new normal. The quarantine era is never ending. We're just trapped in a nightmare, but not for the next hour or so because we're going to have fun, because this is also the 100th episode. It only took me 3 years, I think, 3.5 years. You know what? Sometimes you got to take breaks, and you get to your 100th episode. When you get to your 100th episode of this, is a very special one because we are touching on a recurring theme of the podcast, which is TV legend John Astin. And this week I am joined by none other than Mackenzie Astin. Hello, Mackenzie.
Aloha, Brett. Aloha. Thank you so much for having me on. The next best thing to having John is having one of his issue.
Well, here is the wild thing. So Teenage Bounty Hunters, the show on Netflix that you are a part of, that is phenomenal.
Yes.
So because of my job, I get screeners early. And so I watch shows well before they come out. And I also, like, we'll watch shows having no idea, like, who's in this, what is this, I don't know, I just know that I have to watch it. So watching it, and then when you showed up, I don't know if your name was in the credits at the top,
no,
or, like,
not at the top,
even
no.
In, like, in the guest or whatever, no. So when you showed up, it, unless you have, You resemble your father quite a bit.
We do take after one another.
And that's not always been the case, because I think when I think of Mackenzie Astin, I still think of, like, you know, teen Mackenzie Astin.
Right, right. And the truth is, when I was a younger pup, and my face was less long, I guess, I looked so much more like my mom. Mm-hmm. There are pictures of me, you know, at 15, 16, 17 years old, 19 even, in a movie called Iron Will, where it's literally like watching Patty Duke run a dog sled race.
But now it's, I think it also might be just like the way your hair is done in teen, it's very that Gomez, like, side part kind of thing, that totally. I was just like, oh, this is like if Gomez was a, like, Southern Baptist father of two teenage ragamuffins.
Right. Hey, I actually, I auditioned for it. I had a mustache, and they you know, they requested that I take it off for the job, which I appreciated. Uh-oh. Hang on a second. That's my brother, Sean. I'm so sorry.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah. Well, he can stick it. We're busy right now.
That is the most, that is the most impressive drive-by cameo that the podcast has ever had.
It's not bad. It's not bad. I mean, I guess I could have answered on that computer, but who's here?
How you doing, Brett?
Oh my god! hello, John Astin.
Surprise! Surprise!
Oh wow! I like that. It just totally surprised me. Hello, how are you doing?
Okay. All right.
Thank you for dropping in. This is very surreal.
When I read your story, that was a great angle. In fact, I'm probably going to rewrite my bio.
Yeah,
Brett, he's talking, of course, about the article you wrote on his birthday this year. John Astin is the greatest sitcom guest star of all time.
Yeah, it's true, obviously. I have talked about that many times in this podcast. I'm totally flummoxed and bewildered. But on the podcast, I have talked about The Addams Family, which we're also going to do today, and also Mary, which I love, your 80s
that,
show with
that
Mary
show?
Tyler. Yeah.
That was a terrific show. I think I don't know, but somebody in Newsday saw an episode that they liked a lot, and they had a headline on the story. I mean, it's not exactly what he said, but the headline said, the show should be called the Ed LaSalle Show. And I have a hunch that Mary, you know, because she lived in New York, and she may have seen that, which would not have made her happy.
And it was such a great cast. You also had Katie Siegel, who went on to be on Married with Children.
Yeah.
Such a killer cast. And I really loved all of the episodes that I've seen, and I think more people should see them. I wish that it had lasted longer.
Yeah, we only did about 11 or 12 episodes.
Yeah.
Jimmy Farentino and I used to have lunch. You know, he played the sort of romantic interest for Mary. We used to sit there at lunch and say, this is one great job.
Yeah.
It really was. We both loved working with Mary. And the scripts were funny. And the problem was that the writers were used to rewriting right up until the end. And Mary was used to having something set on, say, Wednesday.
Yeah.
And they were rewriting up until, say, if we had the show on Friday night. I think we did, in fact. But... She really didn't like doing that, and she tried to explain to them. And somehow there was just a lack of communication there, and so she wanted to get new writers. But you see, these writers owned a lot of the show, and there wasn't enough to give away. And so she decided to cancel the show.
God.
Because she couldn't get the writer she wanted. And that was that.
That's such a surprise.
You know, there are things, different things afoot when you go to the studio and realizes that the person you're acting with owns the studio.
Right. That's right. They shot it at what they call MTM, Mary Tyler Moore Studios, CBS Radford. I think it's given name, but you know, it's the house that she built.
Yeah. Through a bunch of my like favorite shows. I mean, I love, you know, Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart Show and all of those really great
Katie
ones.
Katie Sagal was very good.
Yeah. God.
And actually the whole cast was a very, very good cast. And I loved playing that part.
Yeah.
Because I could satirize all the intellectuals I knew.
We also talked about I'm Dickens, He's Finster on the podcast, which I had never seen before. And then I bought the DVD that only has the first half of the series on it. I want to see the second half. But that's another show that I had never heard of until I saw that it was your like first regular gig. And I was like, I need to see this show.
It was my first series.
Yeah.
Well, not my first regular gig. There was one show I was in New York for over 1,000 performances.
Was that Threepenny Pop?
Yeah, the Threepenny Opera.
And that was the American debut of that show, right?
No, the show had played very briefly in the 1930s. And I was the principal member of Mackey's gang. And the character I sat next to on the bench when we were in the same scene together was named Crookfinger Jake. And that's the part that Burgess had played.
Nice.
In the, yeah. And it was in the mid-30s. And it didn't have the Mark Blitzstein translation. And especially with the lyrics, Mark did a terrific job with the lyrics. You know, there were, for example, Brecht was a poet. And so, you know, his lyrics were very good. The song that was called the Army Song, in German, it was Soldatenbohnen auf den Kanonen. That's soldiers live off their guns. And there was nothing, you couldn't translate that and get with that rhythm. So Mark started, let's all go Barmy, live off the army. And then later in the song, we travel into town. And if the population should greet us with indignation, we chop them to bits because we like our hamburgers raw.
Wow.
And so it captured the whole flavor of it. Or the tango ballad was, Ihr meine Zeit, die längst vergangen ist. And and Mark translated that. That was not a literal translation, but he rewrote it a bit so it would work. But there was a time, and now it's all gone by, when we two lived together, she and I.
So when was that, Pop? When was Threepenny? That was in the late 50s?
It opened in, you want to hear an interesting story about that.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, go for it.
I think it's a very profound story, really. An actor, a friend of mine named Alan Bergman, who was probably my best friend. He's unfortunately no longer with us, but he got on the subway and he picked up a copy of the News or the Mirror, one of those. And he saw a little article in it that said, there's an open call for the Threepenny Opera. And that was about all. I mean, it was, you know, like an inch or so, very short. And he called me up and he said, hey, there's an open call for the Threepenny Opera down in the village. He got the address from the newspaper. And So she said, "You want to go?" I said, "Sure." And so the next morning, which is when it was, we went down there, and there was this loft up on the, you know, about four floors up. And we went there, and you could hear, there was a room with a door closed, and you could hear all these opera voices singing, you know, and I tell you, I flashed on something that there is a recording out of a Kurt Weill, a Bert Brecht opera called Mahagoni. And there's a recording out of that that has Audra McDonald starring on it. And she is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, she's always fantastic. But anyway, I had to say it because that I heard it a few weeks ago, and it blew me away. Everybody in it is good, by the way. Patti LuPone is in it, and
legends.
But Audra McDonald is really extraordinary. Anyway, there were all these voices coming from this little room, and Al and I were standing. They had lined up a bunch of guys, and we were in this long line, and they walked sort of up and down the line as though we were standing there for inspection or something, you know. And would you believe it? They picked me out of the line, and they said, "You, come here." And they sent me into that room. And I heard somebody in the back of the room said, "That's the act." And this guy with a mustache, who later turned out to be Mark Blitzstein, said, "Do you sing?" I said, "I can carry a tune." And he said, "Well, okay. Sing Down by the Old Mill Stream." Now that's a difficult song. "Down by the Old Mill Stream, where I first met you, with your eyes of blue, dressed in gingham too." So it took me, you know, a little bit to find a key, and then I sang it. he looked at me. I looked at him, and I said, "Are you equity or non-equity?" And I said, "Which is best?" Because he knew I was going to lie. And and they figured that I was non-equity when I said that. So they didn't say anything, and they just went away. I got a message on my phone service to prepare a singing audition for the Three Penny Opera.
Holy shit.
Alan never heard from anybody. I found a young woman I knew who had done a lot of musicals, and she helped me out. She said, "John, what you want to do is get something where you can talk some of it, you know." And I later found out when I was doing musicals that was a very worthwhile thing to do, because I talk better than I sing. But that I had problems when I in Gilbert and Sullivan. Actually, I succeeded fairly well in Gilbert and Sullivan, but that's just because the part fit me. Anyway, I prepared this audition, and I worked my tail off on it, and I finally got a call to come in and sing. So I came in, I walked in the room. Actually, that's where they said, "That's the actor." Yeah. And I came in, and I was ready to sing this song. I picked to "Brush Up Your Shakespeare," you know, "Brush Up Your Shakespeare." I was talking then. That was not music. Okay. So anyway, this guy with the mustache said, "Did you sing for me?" And I said, "I did 8 bars of Down by the Old Mill Stream." And he said, "What did I say?" And I said, you didn't say anything. You nodded. And they said, all right. And then they asked a question about equity or non-equity and so on. And I left. And based on that, I was cast in the show.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I was in it for well over 1,000 performances.
Gosh. Yeah.
So it was a meal ticket. Of course, it was a scant meal when we were in rehearsal because we got $5 a week for rehearsals.
Jeez.
And $15 a week. That was a non-equity people. Yeah. After we opened, and $25 if we did good business. And we sold out. Actually, every performance sold out. And we got terrible reviews, but we didn't have an empty seat. And most of the standing room was sold every night. And we ran for, and the critics just killed it. As a matter of fact, you know how people collect the quotes from the reviews?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Type them up, put them up on the bulletin board and that sort of thing. And I put up on the bulletin board, I put up all the lousy quotes. Three Penny Opera in Tuppenny production. Three Penny Opera falls flat on its face. Amateurish acting.
Good, and good sense of humor. Good to, you know, not take yourself too seriously. Like
one night, about a 10th performance, Brooks Atkinson, the dean of American critics, came to see it. And ever since opening, we had all the actors had, we'd worked on it, really worked hard. And we happened to have a really good night and the show clicked. And he went back to the Times and wrote a Sunday article that was a rave of the show. And but we had a lease on the theater. This is a theater that's now called the Lucille Lortel Theater. Actually, her husband, whose name was Schweitzer, he made all the cigarette papers that were sold, either in a package or around pre-made cigarettes. And so he was, had a few bucks.
Yeah. In the
and he was married to Lucille. And that's how the theater became the Lucille Lortel Theater. But that was after Threepenny was there. We had to close because our lease ran out. So after 3 months, the show closed. And the next show that was in there, a friend of mine was in that show. Atkinson said, bring back the Threepenny Opera and fast. The current offering is not in the best interests of a stricken city.
Wow. That's high praise.
And then the next play that was in there, he started his review with, bring back the Threepenny Opera.
No shit.
And he did it three times with three shows.
As a super fan.
Yeah, and that really made it. A year and a half later, we reopened. And they cast a little bit, recast a little bit. But it was basically the same show that Atkinson saw that night. And there were some really talented people in it. Charlotte Ray.
Oh, wow.
Was Mrs. Peachum. Joe Sullivan, who later did Most Happy Fella and ended up marrying Frank Lesser, the composer and writer of Most Happy Fella. And
Dooley.
Joe was in it. B. Arthur was in it.
Wow.
With the great voice.
Yeah.
And she played Lucy, and there was one of the numbers is a jealousy duet between Lucy and Polly, and one of the phrases is the little one says he likes a sweet petite girl, and then B would say, He likes a big, complete girl. it was very funny. And they were both terrific in it. And Charlotte was great. I enjoyed the part I played. I'm glad I did. I did it enough.
I have to ask about, because I don't think I've ever heard you talk about one of my favorite roles that you ever did, which is the Riddler on Batman. You're my Riddler. I made my own. I put a Gomez head on this Riddler body because they never make John Astin Riddler stuff. So I was like, I will do this.
I loved doing that.
Yeah.
It was fun. I had always sort of wanted to run around in my underwear, you know, and this was a chance to do it. And I had been working out, so I was in pretty good shape. And
you always have to get in shape for superhero roles.
If you're going to do a Riddler. Yeah.
Yeah. How did you get assigned that? Because then what, like Frank had.
I have no idea.
They just like called you
no
up.
Idea. I had a Threepenny. It was suddenly canceled, not Threepenny, but Adam's Family. And none of us really knew why. Nobody really knew why, because it was, like the reruns, Threepenny Opera ran for about 8 years. At one time, it was the longest running show in New York history.
Wow.
The Fantastics outdid it by a long shot, because their numbers went way, way up. But anyway,
Like Threepenny, the Addams Family was instantly popular?
Yeah, well, the Addams Family, it stayed on the air for 30 or 40 years.
Still now, there's a whole Pluto TV, the streaming service, just has an Addams Family channel that just plays it on a loop. Like, it's still...
That's it's fantastic.
Is that where you saw this? The show that you're talking about today?
No, it's also streaming on Amazon Prime. And so, and I also... Do I own it in multiple formats? Probably. But I when I was watching Batman, I noted that Carolyn Jones did a two-parter as Queen of Diamonds, I think was her character.
Yeah, something
and then
like
a couple that. Episodes later, it's your Riddler episode. So it seems kind of like they were like, oh, they're available now. Let's bring them in.
Yeah. I didn't know when I did it. I didn't know that she had done something on it, too. I guess it hadn't aired at
that
point.
Yeah, probably not.
We were friends for life after we did that show.
Well, it shows. You can see it just the way you guys, having just watched an episode for the first time in a long, long time, but the chemistry is palpable, you know? It's so clear how much you guys love each other and how much the whole family loves each other.
Yeah, yeah.
That was... That was the result of the show. David Levy, who was the creator of the show, it's funny. I did a movie for Filmways, and they got a lot of good preview cards on me when they screened it, you know, on a test screening and so on. And they called me in. And they made a three-picture deal with me. And that sort of stimulated some activity. And where was I going with this?
Oh, Addams Family? Was that getting cast in Addams Family?
Oh, Addams Family. Yeah. Addams Family was one of the projects.
Oh.
And
that works out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they said... interesting thing. They called me in and I came in and the room was, filled with people who were all executives of one sort or another. And there was the desk was commandeered by the CEO of the company, Marty Rantzoff. And Marty was behind the desk and the guy whose desk it was sitting on the sofa, yeah.
Power move.
This guy sitting rather awkwardly on a straight back chair in the center of the room. And the people sitting behind him, he couldn't see. and he could see the desk and my chair, which was next to the desk. And anyway, Marty said, we're going to do the cartoons of Charles Adams, and we want you to play the butler, and you'll have a non-exclusive contract. And I figured, this will never happen. And I started thinking about wearing lifts and so on to be the butler. And I left the meeting thinking that nothing would ever happen. And I got a phone call, and it was David Levy. And he said, now this is a guy, as a matter of fact, he was sitting there, and I said, I don't know you. I said, what have you done? I wouldn't think of it's a terrible thing to ask. But he said, well, I'm producing now, but before that I was vice president of NBC in charge of programming.
Just a little old job. That,
I was vice president of Young and Rubicam for 20 years. And I did the first telecast presidential debates or whatever.
All right, so he was qualified.
Yeah, he knew what was up. Yeah.
Well, actually, he coached Eisenhower for television. That's what he did. He was also involved in the debates too, I think, but which was later. So he called me up and he said, I'd like to buy you a drink. Can you meet me at the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel? And I said, I'd be delighted. Anyway, and so we sat down and ordered martinis, and he said, they kind of gave you the wrong idea in that meeting. He said, this show is really Father Knows Best with other people. And he said, I want you to play the father.
Yeah. Smart move.
I said, wow, that's great. And so we, I don't remember whether we ordered another drink or not, but we we began to discuss the characters. And because I was introduced to it that way, I had a chance to contribute to the character. And so a lot of the good stuff in Gomez was stuff I suggested. I said, I think the romance between the husband and wife should be on a grand scale, a grand romance, nothing pedestrian.
It feels very epic, even though they never leave the living room, basically. Like, every episode is pretty much just in the house, but it feels like they're this worldly love, you know?
Yeah. Well, actually, there were other sets to this. There was the study where Gomez had the trains.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was a dungeon where the bed of nails was. And they also, they had the bedroom a few times. But the first time they had the bedroom, they were trying to comply with the rules. You could not have the married couple in those days sleeping in the same bed.
Yeah.
They had a twin bed, and they had put on the beds. They were like sort of little wooden kids' beds, sort of. And mine said his, and hers said hers, apostrophe S.
Oh, no.
I said, can't you change that? And they didn't have time or something. And
they should
next
have been
time they used it, they took the apostrophe away.
I feel like they should have been his and hearses. Right? Is that
And hers is.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the physicality of Gomez, because like in this episode, in the Portrait of Gomez episode, you're hanging upside down from a chandelier, which I'm assuming was a stunt person, but there are close-ups where you were hanging.
Yeah. There, but it wasn't a chandelier I was on. It was actually a trapeze bar. But
That was you, Pop, the whole time? No double or anything?
I don't remember Chuck doing it. And there are some full shots of me hanging there. but he looked a little bit like me, and he worked on my movements and stuff. So some of the tumbling stuff that was done, he did. But he taught me to hang. He had formerly been in the circus. He was a catcher in the circus. And so he taught me how to hang upside down on the trapeze. That really gets behind your knees.
Yeah, I imagine.
It is very painful at first. And you just have to grin and bear it. And gradually you build up a callus there. And the guy's name was Chuck Couch, who did it. And he was a really fine stunt person.
And you also did all the standing on your head. That was all you, I imagine.
Yeah, actually, the first time it happened, they wired me up. And I didn't like it. And Chuck heard me saying that. He said, I'll show you how to do it. And he did. And oddly, it wasn't that tough for me to do. You just set a three-point thing with your head and two hands, and you balance on those 3 points.
You also,
why don't you show us, Pop?
Yeah, go on, go for it.
You know, I used to be foolish enough in making a public appearance. People would yell out, stand on your head, stand on your head. So I would stand on my head and all the change would fall out of my pockets.
And then that's how they get you.
So I learned to remove the change.
I also wanted to, like, so I have been Gomez for Halloween a couple of times. In quarantine, I even did a half hour Gomez in quarantine show for Instagram, because that's the life I live. The makeup is annoying to get off, because Gomez has like, it's like eyeliner, eyeshadow, like, I don't know, like, what was that experience like getting into like the full goth kind of look?
Well, I wanted to minimize it.
Yeah.
And they wanted to maximize it. And in fact, they wanted me to try to imitate the character that Charles drew.
Yeah, he's this like short, kind of like stumpy, like a
round. Peter Lorre might have done it, you know, but because he had a round face, you know. I said it would get in the way of the romance, you know. They wanted me to shave my head up to here, you know, like this.
Yeah, like that weird bowl cut kind of thing that he has in the art. Like, it's a really...
And they put a lot on there.
Yeah.
And it became a big fight. And
who won?
This was the first season, not long after we opened. And I remember being told by the head of television, if you don't like it, you can quit.
Jeez. Well,
and I thought, whoa. Now, I know Carolyn had been dissatisfied about something, and they acted right away. They found somebody, put her in Carolyn's costume, and Carolyn came around. But I knew they would never find anybody as good as Carolyn, because she was the last person cast, and we auditioned with many people, and some very beautiful women would come in, and they just didn't have it, you know, and Carolyn did.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a Morticia until somebody thought of offering the part to Carolyn, and she didn't have to read for it or anything.
She's top billed. Like, she's the first name on the show in the opening credits.
Actually, my contract said top billing, actually.
Oh.
And they told me that Carolyn wanted it, and I gave it to her.
How very Gomez.
Yeah, very loving, yeah. Very loving.
I don't know if she knew that I did that, but uh-huh. I wanted her to do the part, you know, and
obviously,
if something would stand in the way. And I always had in my mind that in Route 66, Martin Milner was billed over George Maharis in that. And it was George Maharis who emerged from the show.
Yeah.
Based on the performance. I think he was the original character in Edward Albee's The Zoo Story.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, if I can just throw in something about Carolyn, you know, having just watched an episode, like I said, for the first time in a long, long time, and when I was younger, having, you know, watching the show, of course, my eyes are automatically drawn to my dad and watching what he's doing and what he's up to. But this recent rewatch really, really, really gave me a much more clearer indication of how much strength she brought to it and how much, how much the family dynamic was dependent on her direction. And the strength and
the vibe between the two of us.
Oh yeah,
exactly. And it was just it was one of the things that really struck me just watching it yesterday and again today. And that, and for me again, and I'll shut up in a second, is obviously watching your stuff, Bob, which is so great. But Jackie Coogan's timing is just so it's preternatural, just so damn good.
Yeah, but
all of you guys, the timing
I
together.
I always enjoyed scenes with Coogan because of that, Mac. He was a real trooper.
Ugh.
Well, in this episode, you have the really funny moment where he's taking your photograph. And like the tripod is buckling, and so he's getting lower, and then you're getting lower, and then just like you're both like flat on the floor, which I think is so that physical stuff.
Yeah. If my pants weren't going to rip, I would have been able to do a split there. But I don't know if you know this, we're in danger of going.
Did y'all find that physical comedy like during rehearsals, or was that written in the script, or like how did y'all develop those kind of physical gags?
I don't know. Some of them were written. An awful lot of the writing, and he's not credited for it, was done by the producer, who was Nat Perrin.
Yeah.
Nat Perrin had come to Hollywood at the request of the Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
To write for them.
It's a big pedigree.
Yeah, and he would do stuff that was reminiscent of some of the stuff that they did. I remember one time he said to me, you remember the, he said, my boy, he almost calls me my boy, said, my boy, do you remember the stateroom scene with the crowded stateroom? And I said, yeah. He said, do you think we could do that with Cousin It's Room? And he was another person on that show who became a friend. I really loved that guy. And his stuff was so funny. He had a great sense of humor. And I miss him. I had a great opportunity at the Friars Club in Beverly Hills. There was a table, a couple of the guys who were the first writers on the Addams Family were Ed James and Seaman Jacobs. Mm-hmm. And they were both of them, they were a writing team. And they wrote for Bob Hope, actually.
Jeez.
They were part of that team of writers that was with Bob Hope. And so a lot of the former Bob Hope writers would have lunch there at the Friars Club. And Nat and David got me into that lunch. And at the table, frequently, actually, was Sid Caesar was at that table frequently. And the guy who was the head writer on that show of shows that picked all those later to become famous writers to be on that show, to write for that show, like the Simon Brothers and Woody Allen.
Carl Reiner?
Shelley Keller and Larry Gelbart.
Mm-hmm.
They were people that this guy, Mel Tolkien, T-O-L-K-I-N.
Yeah, right.
And his son, Michael Tolkien, is a very fine writer. He wrote The Player. He's written other stuff that I really loved. I'm a fan of his.
So we're in the Friars Club in the middle.
Oh, yeah. These people sitting around this table. And there was Mel. There would be Mel sometimes. Hal Cantor, who was one of Bob Hope's number one writers, actually, and a wonderful guy, a very distinguished man. There were Hal, Sid Caesar, Ed James, Seaman Jacobs, other of the Bob Hope writers.
Right.
Now would also be there. Sometimes Louis Nye would show up and sit at the table, and that was always a delight. And occasionally Carl Reiner would come and sit down with us and be part of the table. And so it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you're around so much. Well, you are a legend. That's what I was gonna say. You're around so much history, but it's like, well, you are history. Like, you are an icon of television
part
history.
Part of the tapestry.
Yeah, like, and you got to work with so many fantastic people. I also really loved your Odd Couple episode. What was the difference between because that was shot in front of like a live studio audience, whereas like Adam's Family was single camera, or it was more shot like a film, right?
Well, that episode of The Odd Couple.
Oh, was that in the first season?
I was very friendly with both Tony and the people who wrote that show.
Yeah.
It was Gary Marshall and Jerry Belson,
mm-hmm,
who wrote it. It was not a show that the network liked at that stage.
Yeah.
And they called me up and they said, one of the two writers, or it might have been Tony, I don't know, we had a lovely relationship. Whoever it was said that they didn't think the show worked with the laugh track or with the audience, and they wanted to show that the show was really funny without a laugh track and so they wrote this very funny character for me to play, Buffy.
Yeah.
It was a, you know, takeoff on Hugh Hefner.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really enjoyed playing it, but I did certain things in it that would provoke a laugh regardless of a track or not. And somehow the network people saw what was happening there and said, let's go with the show. And The Odd Couple became a huge hit. I don't know. Did you watch it a lot, Mac?
Well, I've seen some of it in reruns, but it
was one of Tom's favorite shows.
I think it's light. I mean, I would have been pretty small.
It's 70, like 70 to 75. Yeah,
yeah. It predates me by 3 years. And so, but I do remember watching some of it in reruns, obviously. It's funny because it took me a second to accept the performance, to accept Lemon and Matthau, because I'd gotten accustomed to Randall and Klugman.
Yeah.
When I saw the film, you know, which was first, obviously, I was like, well, who are these fucking guys?
Yeah. These aren't my guys. What?
Right. I was wondering, just having watched.
They overtook the original people in it.
Yeah. Right. On stage, you mean?
Yeah. Well, it was actually Matthau and Art Carney.
On stage, and then Lemon did the movie?
Yeah.
Wild. Yeah. Wild. You know what I was thinking when I was watching the episode Portrait of Gomez? Because the laugh track is evident.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering what it would. I mean, because it's interesting because it's funny anyway.
Yeah.
And our approach to laugh tracks now is so much different than it would have been presumably in 65, 66, 64, 65, 66. But I wonder what it would be like to watch the show without the laugh track at all, if there's any way to pull it out.
Oh, I'm sure people can.
My feeling was I didn't like it.
Sure.
And so I wanted to make sure they heard the lines, but I threw away a lot of lines. And the post-production guys would come to me and they would say, "Hey, John, could you give us a little more punch at the end of some of those lines? We'd like to give you more of a laugh on there." I said, "Well, hell, I'll give it a try," and I never did. You know, because that reassured me that if I kept on doing what I was doing, they wouldn't put too much laugh in after my stuff.
I also, there's a really funny line in this where they say like, "I'm going to wear my best suit," and you're like, "Yeah, I found my best suit. I bought 12 of them," because like that Gomez suit is one of my favorite all time suits. Every Halloween, I come around of like, I just want a, you know, navy pinstripe suit just to own. And I'm like, I could use Halloween as an excuse. I could do it. And I never get around to it. I don't know. What was it like kind of wearing the same thing every episode? I mean, did it get monotonous at all? Or?
I always knew where it was.
What were there 12? Did you actually have multiple of those suits?
No. In the first year, I had one, and then they got another one, and I can tell the difference between the two.
No shit.
The different cut in the slightly different cut.
What was the lining of the pocket of the coat pocket, the vest pocket, so you could throw the cigar in there?
Asbestos.
Wait, that's fantastic.
I was worked on sound stages repeatedly for many years, and the walls were made of asbestos.
Oui.
And they would cut that pocket filler right in front of me, and the flakes of asbestos would come up into the air.
Oh, jeez.
And they were all over me. And, you know, they'd brush it off the suit.
That's fine.
Shoot it. So I'm fortunate that I didn't pick something up from that.
Yeah.
I also really like in this episode, the very first scene is a classic Addams Family moon bathing scene. And your, I don't know, moon suit bathing? I don't know what that. I really love that, I guess, swimsuit kind of, that stripedy get up.
Yeah, it was a 1904 swimsuit.
Were those custom? Was all the stuff made for you, or was that like a vintage, like 50-year-old swimsuit that they found?
No, this was an economical show, and a lot of the stuff was actually my suits were from Western Costume, and so others had worn them.
Wow. That would be such an exciting kind of detective cinephile job to try to track Gomez's suit before it was Gomez's suit.
No, don't give me a project. I've already done. I've already documented everything Bob Newhart wore in the Bob Newhart Show. So, and I love Gomez so much. And I was like, I could do that for Gomez, but it's like he wears a suit and it's sometimes the swimsuit. Sometimes a fur coat and top hat over the suit. Well, in this episode, you also wear the driving outfit. You have the white coat and the like goggles and stuff. Do you remember anything about shooting those car scenes? Was that like actually driving on a set?
One of the complaints the network had is that the people who were doing the show didn't go out more, and their phrase was open the show up more. That was right in the studio. They driving, the DMV or whatever it was one of the offices at Filmways,
Yeah. I could. It's funny. I could almost recognize one of the shot that's on the fellow that gives you the driving test. There's one shot of him when you guys get back from the test having gone crazily wrong, where you can see the top of one of the sound stages in the background. And I, you know, I'm not unfamiliar with that lot. I've auditioned there a number of times in the past, 20 years. And so I was trying to picture, trying to recognize if I knew exactly the corner of which building that was. But it's interesting. I wanted to ask you, Pop, and I don't know if you can, recall this, but the shot where you guys are just outside the house, the mansion, before you get to the DMV, which is hysterical because Cousin It, Felix, I would imagine, is underneath the hood with the curlers in his hair. And you do a wonderful bit where you're ready to go forward and you say, Alevante, and then the car reverses. Well, and I was curious as to whether that was, three or four Teamsters and burly grips pulling the car, or if you were actually, if you had it in gear and reversed as you were expecting to drive forward. I would presume on the stage that they probably wouldn't have the car running, but who knows, maybe the asbestos would just absorb the CO2.
No, that was not on a sound stage, though. That was on the lot.
That was on the lot.
Yeah, but it was a small lot, right off of Santa Monica Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
And in the middle of Los Angeles. So there was enough smog there to
to sell it.
Pollute the breathing situation.
Right.
I wanted to ask McKinsey, did you ever visit your father while he was working on any sets or anything? You're obviously too young for Adam's Family, but did you ever go?
Plenty of them. I was actually lucky enough to visit the set of the Adam's Family Halloween special in 1978.
Yes.
Which was a terrific and a delight and in color,
yeah.
Which I think might have thrown some people off, to be honest. But it was, I was tiny. I would have been four or five.
Yeah, five.
Yeah, visiting the set. And so, I have scant memories of it, but it was wonderful, and a number of other sets over the years. I didn't visit him. God, I don't think I visited him on the Facts of Life set. He was in an episode in the I think it's the sixth season early on, and it's later in that season is the first time the character that I played for four seasons thereafter was on. But I can't remember if I visited you on that set. I know I went to the set of the Charmingtons. I think that was a show, the Charmingtons.
Oh, the Charmings.
The Charmings. That's right. That's where I
whatever
had...
happened to that show.
Well,
that was a good episode.
It was a great episode. I had a very, very scary experience for a young man who knows some secrets, who was terrified for his father's sense of dignity. And I'll tell it, Pop. I hope you don't mind. Right?
No, not a problem.
So my dad wore a toupee for a number of years after his hair went away, but for work, because people recognized him as a fellow with a head of hair. And
however, in the Adams Family, that's my real hair.
Yes, of course.
In the Adams Family, with some spritz on there. That's sort of the Frank Sinatra method.
Some spritz.
And then finally, he had to wear a tube.
Since you brought it up, just as quick side note or whatever, that's honestly something I've always wondered, because when I see game show appearances, when you would do like Beat the Clock and like Tattletales and stuff like that, you look as you do now. And that's in between, you're not wearing the toupee at that point, but then you're acting, you are. And I was like, that's really cool, because there are a lot of actors that, get that toupee and then cling to it. And it's like, you will never see me without it. And I just always respected the fact that you were like very upfront of like, this is how I look. I'm going to go on a TV show. Like, this is, a difference between John Astin and the characters you're playing. I don't know. I just thought that was cool.
I wore the toupe in daily life for a while, probably a little too long. because the wig maker I used, who was a real artist, had actually worked with Bert Brecht in the Banana Ensemble.
To bring it all home.
Yeah.
He and his wife. But he retired and moved to Hawaii. And
you were neither here nor there.
I don't know if he's still around, but
so you did this. So there was an episode of The Charmings in I don't know, 84, maybe 85, 86, somewhere in there. And you played the devil, Dad. You were the devil. That was the actual character. You were the devil. But they didn't know within the context of the show, they didn't know you were the devil. And there was a big reveal at one point where you said something clever and you started to sing and dance the song Soul Man, the Sam and Dave, I think it's Sam and Dave, Soul Man. You know, it's a relatively popular.
Yeah.
But what happened?
I did a Brown imitation.
Right. James Brown in it.
You know, with my leg out and
right. So, but a huge fan comes on. One of those big mothers, like 5 feet, you know, wide.
Yeah.
To blow all this crazy smoke through the set, and it was a 4-camera tape show. So the audience is there. The cameras are all set. The scene is happening. I'm totally unaware of what's gonna happen. The music comes up. Dad does the dance. The fan comes on. They reveal he's the devil. He's singing Soul Man. And the wind is blowing so, 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 so hard. And I am in utter terror that his toupee is going to fly off in front of all these people. And like, you know, and there will be a moment of great embarrassment for my dad, the actor. And so I said to him afterwards, you know, the little kid, I said to him, I'm so glad that your piece didn't come off. I was so worried it wouldn't come off. He said, Macker, I've got that thing stapled down. I will add that John, the individual, my dad, the Joker in real life, also pulled one of the greatest fast ones in personal life that I have ever experienced, which was this. He was still wearing a toupee in daily life. He started dating the lady to whom he has now been married for 30 years, almost 31. Or it is 31.
It's over 31.
Shit. So they were just starting to date. And my stepmom, Val, was over at the apartment at my dad's place. And I was hanging out and we were sitting in the living area. And he decided to pull a fast one. And very casually, while we're all hanging out, undid one clip, very casually undid another clip on the sides. And then he has historically been a tremendous sneezer, the kind of guy that really gets into a sneeze to let it all out. I mean, you could ask any one of my siblings the sound of my dad sneezing, and they will all say barhoony. It's this very particular sound. So very casually undoes the clips, starts to build up a big sneeze, lets it go, and this fucking tube flies off his head. So it lands flat in front of his face because the top stick is still right at the crown. And I think the relationship is over. I'm like, oh no, Val is going to freak out. She's going to run screaming from this apartment. I cannot believe how embarrassing this moment is. And I look over and the two of them are giggling like school kids. The school kids. They set me up.
I love that so much.
So great. Do you remember that, Pop?
Very well.
Oh, man, you nailed me. You got me good.
You know how I began to sneeze that way?
No, I don't.
Well, when I grew a mustache, I didn't want to get any what Val would have called Hanabata from my nose onto the mustache.
Uh-huh.
And I found a way to sneeze without exhaling through my nose. I made it all come through my mouth.
A professional.
And that's why it's the way it is.
That's completely insane.
What a scoop.
And brilliant, and absolutely brilliant. A capital idea, if you will.
Did you grow the mustache for Gomez? Because you didn't have one on Dickens and Finster.
No. I was then with an agency called Creative Artists Association, and I had a good relationship with an agent named Roland Perkins, who was a very fine agent. And we were discussing what might be viable, you know. And so Roland got me an episode of The Farmer's Daughter, the show with Inger Stevens and Bill Windham. And they played husband and wife, and he was a congressman. And so I played a congressman, and I remember a very nice actress named Ann Helm played my wife in that show. And I wore a mustache. And when Roland saw the show, he said, "Why don't you give it a try? It looked pretty good." Huh. And so I started to grow it, and there was a telethon that I did a lot of the telethon hosting with Mac's mom in New York, but I, this was before that, it was a muscular dystrophy thing still, but this was from Los Angeles, and I decided to see what it looked like on that telethon, and I did that, and it wasn't long after that that I got the call about the Addams Family. That was a 1964,
I think, was when Addams Family started.
1964.
Did they want to make you shave your mustache for the Riddler? Did that ever come up?
Okay. No, I wasn't shaving it then, no matter what.
I have to get something real quick because that's it's relevant. This is very unprofessional of me, but
no, that's fine. We'll fill the air. So,
how you been?
Not bad, Pop. How's your day going?
Okay.
Hey, did you eat that? Did you eat the?
I haven't eaten anything yet.
I'm back.
Are you kidding me? No, I'm going to eat it afterwards.
So
here we were catching up.
Oh. But thanks for bringing it.
This is a piece of art that I did. It says my Riddler has a mustache.
That's fantastic! I love it.
So I have these.
That's terrific.
I have a bunch of these. I have buttons. Yeah, that's because again, if no one's gonna make John Aston Riddler merchandise, I will fill the void. And I broke my professional hosting duties to go fetch that. Because when
that's
else?
Okay. That's okay. I think you'll enjoy our. Well, hopefully you'll enjoy the exchange. While you're away. Oh, you can probably hear us. Oh, no,
I think my headphones on. Oh, jeez. I'm going to have to go back and edit.
It was decent is what it was. It was decent.
A whole bunch of expletives flying. No, I don't care. I don't want to take up all of your time. I feel so blessed and honored. I could honestly do this for a telethon for just the rest of quarantine. Are y'all quarantined together or...
I'm going to walk out of the shot here. We're about a mile apart.
We're quarantined separately.
Yeah.
Yes.
That is, Val and I are together here, and Mac and Jennifer are together in their place.
I feel for all the people that are quarantined alone right now. I don't know how people are doing that. And John, you're still teaching.
Right.
Correct. Like, that's amazing.
And I gotta do some writing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can call it a day if you have to get to work. I am completely honored.
Well, there's a show at 5 o'clock that I gotta do.
Oh no.
This is that show, Dad.
Oh, this is that show?
Oh,
that's good. So I made it.
Yeah.
Got here in time. No, this has been fun. I've enjoyed it a lot. And there are more stories.
I mean, I am always up for sequels, a whole running series of stories. I mean, I didn't even get to ask you about Step by Step, which I'm sure
about
Step by Step. I mean, you got to hang out with the Code Man.
Which episode are you talking about?
I mean, you did two or three. You did a Christmas one, two. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
not sure, but I think it's just
you almost committed suicide by jumping out a plane.
Right.
TJIF got dark. It was a really dark episode.
Right.
Yeah.
You, You and Patrick Duffy were good buddies, yeah.
They wrote interesting stuff.
It seems like you were the kind of person that a show was like, we need a guest star who's going to knock it out of the park. Get John Astin. Like, that seems like what the Charles in Charge episode, the Webster episodes, like, like, it just seems like that's what it was. I mean, were people, I'm sure you didn't have to audition for all those roles.
No. Yeah. The Charles in Charge was the pickle king.
Yeah. The range.
And he made the pickles.
You go from that to playing an ice cream salesman on Step by Step. Like, what? All the food.
Well, that first episode, not the one falling through space, but the one where we got the ice cream headaches.
Yeah.
That was really an unusual. I mean, both shows were very unusual. I enjoyed them.
There's so many things I could ask about, but I also just want to touch upon Grandpapa Adams, since we have been mostly talking about Adams Family. While I have you, I feel like I need to ask, what was it like playing against another Gomez?
Well, I got a kick out of putting the costume back on.
Yeah.
Because it had been quite a while.
Probably about 20 years or so. That was the
late. Interesting thing was, Fox had bought the right to use the original scripts for the shows. That's what that show was based on.
Oh.
And I saw the ones that I did, but I didn't see anything else.
It was just really cool seeing you as Gomez on those shows, because you don't miss a beat. It's like 30 years later from the original series, but you are still at the same energy level as always.
<That's>
I mean, how did you do all of those physical stunts? I mean, were you a very physical performer back when, you know?
Yeah. In the course of my career, I did a lot of stunts.
Yeah.
Actually, Dickens and Fenster, I didn't have a double. So all of that stuff that involved me doing it, I did. And the stuntmen who were hired occasionally to come on the show were very nice to me and showed me things that helped keep me from injury, actually.
They kept Gomez alive, which is all we want. Well, yeah. It has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for being around to celebrate my 100th episode. This is the best.
Here's wishing you the best for the next 100.
Yeah, which I hopefully will be out of quarantine and I can do them in person again, but... It's been fun.
if people don't start treating this pandemic as something real.
Yeah, as serious as it actually is. And I am.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, I'm not going out. I'm staying here.
Please.
At my age, you know, I'm a target risk for that thing.
And
yeah.
No,
well, here's hoping the 200th episode is one that we can breathe freely upon.
Yeah. I'll drive down to Baltimore. I'll rent a car. I'll come down to a live event.
Hey, Pop, thanks for surprising us, man.
Yeah.
That's a great move.
It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. I will continue to also write more glowing things about the great John Astin for the rest of my life.
Oh, that's lovely. It's lovely.
And that does it for this episode of Must Have Seen TV, the 100th episode. Thanks again to my guests, Mackenzie Astin and TV legend John Astin, for dropping by and talking about the Addams Family and Batman and Step by Step and The Odd Couple and just... legends and tales with me. Next time I'll be discussing, you know what, I don't know what, I can't think at all right now. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Brett White. Follow the podcast at Must Have Seen TV. Thanks to Acast for hosting the podcast. Go to decider.com and read my John Astin is the best sitcom guest star ever post, because it's true. It fully is. Thanks to Acast for hosting the podcast, if I didn't say that already. Thanks to everyone for listening. And you know what? We're now in the holiday gauntlet. So I'll see you next time on Must Have Seen TV Halloween.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.